We're breaking down the COVID booster shot rollout and what's in store for kids. We have a pair of physicians from the Medical College of Wisconsin fielding your COVID questions on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. The FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, has authorized Pfizer's shot for some groups, and news outlets are reporting that the FDA is set to dramatically expand the use of COVID booster shots soon. Have you gotten your COVID booster? Did you get a J&J vaccine and wonder about the possibility of mixing and matching vaccines? We've been hearing about that. 800-642-1234. Dr. Frank Zhu is a pediatric infectious disease physician and medical director of infection control and prevention at Children's Wisconsin. Dr. Zhu, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Good morning. We also have Dr. Mary Beth Graham with us, an internal medicine and infectious disease specialist at the Medical College of Wisconsin, where she's a professor of medicine, associate chief in the Division of Infectious Diseases. Dr. Graham, welcome back.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, let's start with you, Dr. Graham. You know, the death of Colin Powell this week, the former Secretary of State, and, you know, reminds us how dangerous COVID is to older people and to people who are immunocompromised. His death at 84, even though fully vaccinated. Can you reflect a bit on this demographic that remains vulnerable to infections despite being vaccinated?
Well, the key thing with General Powell, and I just found this out yesterday reading on the internet, he had a history of multiple myeloma. And so not only was he in an age group that would have a decreased immune response to vaccine, but having multiple myeloma, it's a particular bloodstream malignancy that can significantly decrease the way the body can make an immune response to a vaccine. And when I read that, I thought, oh, that's, and I've taken care of plenty of patients at Medical College of Wisconsin Frederick Hospital who have had multiple myeloma, have gotten their vaccines, and have not been able to mount an antibody response. So those certain conditions could, I mean, that probably played a huge part in his ability to fight off the infection.
I see. I see. Dr. Zhu, you're a pediatrician. I'd imagine you're fielding a lot of questions about kids getting vaccinated. What is the latest that you can share about a COVID vaccine for kids?
Right. So, I mean, currently the Pfizer vaccine is approved for children above the age of 12 and above. And Pfizer has submitted the vaccine for ages 5 to 11 for emergency use authorization in late September. So we'll have to see the FDA and the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, ACIP, hasn't yet approved that, but they do have a meeting this week and then meeting in early November. So we'll have to see if they come up in those meetings.
Yeah. And, you know, children are not just small adults here. What needs to be different about a child's version of the COVID vaccine from what you would give an adult?
Right. Generally, the difference is to make sure that the doses you give to children are both immunogenic and are sort of adequate. So they may give sort of smaller doses to children since, you know, pediatrics and children are generally, can be smaller in size. So for the 12 to sort of 18-year-olds, they're currently given the same dose as adults. But for the 5 to 11-year-olds, they're being recommended a dose that is about a third of the dose to adults. So it's 10 micrograms instead of 30 for Pfizer. And at least Pfizer's data, they say that it has a similar immunogenic response. But of course, the ACIP has not yet reviewed the data and it's not public yet.
Yeah, yeah. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Frank Zhu, a pediatric infectious disease specialist. Dr. Mary Beth Graham is here, internal medicine and infectious disease specialist, both from the Medical College of Wisconsin, fielding your questions about the COVID vaccine and boosters, 800-642-1234. David is joining us from California. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Yeah, morning. And believe it or not, I'm calling you from the safe city of San Francisco.
Ah.
Our death count, I'm not sure if we've reached 650 yet, but there are other counties out here. Kevin McCarthy's district is, what is it, 2,500 dead or so? A couple of the reddest counties, Orange County, they're over 5,000 dead. We're 600 because we made sure the homeless got vaccinated. We made sure that everybody got a free test as soon as they could possibly get it. You know, Glide Church out here was doing free tests last autumn when Kaiser was refusing people for months to get a test.
So you really ramped up where you are, ramped up that public health effort is what I'm hearing, and got people vaccinated, David.
Right. Well, my bigger question is, how many variants are there now? You know, there used to be just one disease, then there were three variants, and now it's gotten stupid. And I'm worried about the patent rights.
Okay. Well, David, I just want to pause there and allow Dr. Graham to address variants and what is known. Dr. Graham, go ahead.
So all viruses mutate. So, I mean, this is just a natural thing. So this is an RNA virus. Whenever it replicates, it is going to have changes in its genetic code. And every single time it changes, it potentially could be a variant. But what we track from the CDC and the WHO are things like variants of interest, variants of concern, variants of high consequence. And so even though the virus is always changing, because again, that's a natural process when the virus replicates, if they change themselves in such a way that they can either change how infectious they are to people or how they would potentially respond to a vaccine, that's when they get on people's radar with regards to being a variant. So the predominant variant in the United States is Delta, mm-hmm. and has been for several months. Outside the United States, we've got Mu, we have Lambda. Those, though, do not seem to be spreading the same way that Delta did. But again, could they do that? Yes, they potentially could, because again, as this virus replicates, it has the chance to mutate and again, change itself so it's more fit to spread from person to person. And even though you have Delta, there are subgroups of Delta. So Delta isn't just one virus. There are dozens and dozens of subgroups of Delta.
Yeah. And, you know, Dr. Zhu, I want you to be able to jump in here in that, you know, I think I was hearing from Dr. Fauci that you don't want to allow this virus any opening to replicate because then it mutates and every mutation could, you know, give us a new challenge. What do you see there?
Right. And Dr. Fauci is certainly correct in that. And this is sort of emphasizes the need to sort of have a global perspective in terms of preventing COVID spread and vaccination and to sort of minimize the amount of viruses that are actively replicating and prevent the development of new variants. Because remember, with Delta, it emerged rather rapidly over the course of this year. It was sort of first found in India, where it really ravaged that population and then spread globally. So it really just shows that it can, you know, a variant from across the globe can very rapidly take over here in the U.S.
We have pediatric infectious disease specialist Frank Zhu, infectious disease specialist Mary Beth Graham here, both of the Medical College of Wisconsin. They're fielding your questions about the COVID vaccine and boosters. Are you still waiting to schedule your initial round of the COVID vaccine? What has got you on the fence about it? Have the children 12 and up in your household been vaccinated? What do you want to know about kids and COVID? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. An immunization advisory panel for the CDC is set to meet tomorrow to discuss COVID booster shots. We're discussing booster vaccines with a pair of physicians on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. An advisory panel for the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, they voted unanimously last week to recommend the agency authorize a booster dose for the J&J COVID vaccine for people 18 and over. Still time to talk COVID boosters. What you want to know, 800-642-1234. We have pediatrician Frank Zhu and infectious disease physician Mary Beth Graham. Dr. Graham, you know, the FDA authorizing Pfizer's shot for some groups, likely hearing a green light for boosters from Moderna and J&J soon. So who can get a booster now?
So with the Pfizer vaccine, which is our only FDA-approved vaccine currently on the market, the approval for the booster is for those individuals over the age of 65, for our immunocompromised patients. What is interesting is that the FDA advisory panel originally only suggested it for those two groups, but what happened after the vaccine was full FDA approved, the ACIP suggested that it also be broadened to frontline healthcare workers, to grocery store workers, to EMTs, et cetera. So that's an entire group that's also being recommended to get the booster at least 6 months after their second dose of the Pfizer vaccine that they received. What is now being considered by the FDA, and again, those are both under emergency use authorization, and they're looking to give emergency use authorization for the boosters for both Moderna and also for J&J. Mm-hmm. For the J&J, it's actually interesting. They are suggesting on that one, what's been recommended by the advisory committee is that anybody who received J&J, anybody, no caveats with it, receive another J&J shot within 2 months of having received the first one. That's what went through the advisory committee. And that has to do with the lower antibody titers that they saw with J&J as compared to initially as compared to the mRNA vaccines. And for Moderna, it very much replicates or looks very similar to Pfizer in terms of what has been recommended is over the age of 65, immunocompromised, and those individuals who are at high risk or who have jobs who would put them potentially at risk of exposure. So again, healthcare workers, our police force, our frontline EMTs, et cetera. Yeah.
So a smaller group there. And, you know, we've also heard, Dr. Graham, about mixing and matching vaccines, you know, not authorized yet. But what is your sense there of what could happen? Like, you know, I got a J&J or Moderna and then I could get a Pfizer booster.
So this is fascinating. I mean, the immunology of this is fascinating. So I don't want people to take away that J&J is a crummy vaccine. What's interesting about it is even though antibody titers were low to begin with, if you look over time for the other parts of the immune response, whether we call it cellular immunity, humoral immunity, antibodies versus T cells, the J&J does excellent. What is interesting though, with the J&J, in the studies that have been done is if you just look at antibody titers, if you boost with another adenovirus vaccine, which the J&J is adenovirus vaccine based, you got about a fourfold rise in your amount of antibody. If you boosted with Pfizer, I think it was something around 17 to 20 fold increase in antibody titer. If you boosted with a full dose of the Moderna, it was 76 times higher. Wow. I mean, it was just phenomenal. So what they are noticing is that, and there have been other papers reported, if you've got Pfizer being boosted with Moderna, Moderna being boosted with Pfizer, is that because these are different, and again, as Dr. Zhu pointed out, there's 10 micrograms of the mRNA antigen in the Pfizer, there's 100 in the Moderna, and that may be why it acts a little bit differently. And for their booster, they're looking at a half dose, which would be 50 micrograms, but they're not exactly the same. So if you mix vaccines, you may have a more heterogeneous immunologic response. This is kind of reflective, though, of what they're seeing with people who had COVID previously. So, I'd be interested if people would call in on this, people who previously had COVID, let's say last fall, who then get the vaccine, there is a lot in the literature right now talking about hybrid immunity or super immunity.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
those individuals who previously had COVID, who then got vaccinated, regardless of which vaccine, but I think most of the studies were done with the mRNA vaccines, is that there is this very robust, very, again, heterologous immune response that may be broader and may be better to prepare somebody for variants if they do arise.
We're talking with Dr. Mary Beth Graham, Medical Director of Infection Prevention and Control for Froedtert Hospital. Dr. Frank Zhu is here, Medical Director of Infection Control and Prevention at Children's Wisconsin. Let's go to Jody in Appleton. Jody, hi, and you have concerns about your granddaughter who is 17 and had a Pfizer vaccine.
Yes, she had, her whole family got COVID last fall. A little time after that, she got really sick again, and she was tested, and it said COVID again. She ended up getting a Pfizer vaccine. I think it was May, May. She broke out head to toe. I took care of her for 3 or 4 days. She had hives. I ran her to the pediatrician. They put her on steroids for 3 days, but that she just continued breaking out, so they extended it to cover a week. They said she can't have her second Pfizer. Her parents just took her to an allergist a couple weeks ago, and they ran allergy tests, and she's allergic to a lot of things, but he also said she shouldn't have the second one. So, like, I'm wondering as a grandmother, like, is there a test for antibodies? I mean, what's her future look like?
Jody, thank you for explaining the situation. Dr. Zhu, go ahead.
Right. So with any vaccine, and specifically with Pfizer and Moderna recently with the COVID vaccine, sort of allergic reactions are certainly possible to it. And if you remember, originally in early December when they were first authorized for emergency use, there were reported cases of significant allergic reactions that were rare. And those turned out to be about 5 per million doses is what the current data has sort of shown when they've reviewed it. So for your granddaughter, it seems like she had a significant allergic reaction, but not anything that, you know, stopped her from breathing or was anything life-threatening. But because of that, it's not recommended that she gets any more vaccinations of that type. As for measuring immunity, currently, while it's a little bit of a mixed bag, while antibody tests have been used generally to sort of look at immune response, they're not really a effective way to look at how efficacious the vaccine is in preventing disease yet, although likely a higher antibody would mean you're more productive. Mm-hmm. So the CDC doesn't really recommend you use antibody levels as a measure of vaccine effectiveness because, like Dr. Graham said, there are a variety of other factors such as your T-cell response and things like that aren't measured by antibodies, which also play a role and are made in response to vaccination.
Jody, thank you. Let's go to Dave in Milltown now. Dave, hi. What is your question?
Hello.
Yes, hi.
I had a COVID episode in April of 2021. I had fever symptoms. I was very fatigued, and the symptoms persisted for about 2 weeks. What I want to know is my natural immunity superior to the COVID vaccine? Do I have to get a COVID vaccine now?
Let's take that to Dr. Graham. Go ahead, Dr. Graham.
So you will have some level of natural immunity after having had it. Most of the studies that are out there suggest that people who get, again, that vaccine after having had COVID have a much better immune response and, again, can have what is referred to as this hybrid immunity that may protect you even further. So the recommendation, even if you had COVID, and we know that there is natural immunity, is that we would strongly suggest people also get the vaccine to bolster that immunity and make it even stronger.
Very quickly, Dr. Graham, Dick in Watertown has had the vaccine and wonders, will the booster tell our body not to work so hard?
No. I guess. I mean, that's actually a very interesting question.
Yeah.
I would say that, I mean, the issue is that when you get vaccines, is that you're priming it so that you've got the arms of your immune system ready to fight if it sees a pathogen come into you, regardless of what type of vaccine it is, whether it's the pneumococcal vaccine, the influenza vaccine, et cetera. And essentially it essentially arms you better so that you're better to fight. So you can fight more efficiently. Let's put it that way. You can fight much, much more efficiently because your body's going to figure out how to fight something in general, if you've got a good immune system, but that vaccine will help.
Thank you both for joining us. Dr. Mary Beth Graham, internal medicine and infectious disease specialist. Dr. Frank Zhu, pediatric infectious disease physician, both at the Medical College of Wisconsin, here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about a relationship cut short by war.
Some people that we meet might only be in our lives momentarily, but they can have a profound effect on us that can last a lifetime. Jeffrey Saunders, a private first class in the 101st Airborne Division of the U.S. Army, had that effect on Adriana Bonowitz. She shared her experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
My name is Leonora Adriana Rosado Bonowitz. I'm in Libertyville, Illinois. I was 16 years old, and my mother sent me to my uncle's house in Miami during a vacation period. During this vacation, my cousin invited me to a party, and I met this young man from Jamaica. He lived there and had come also to Miami to visit his mother and sister. He was American citizen only in paper. His mother had registered him at the American Embassy when he was born, but he grew up in Jamaica and was Jamaican in his heart. This was sometime during the Vietnam War. And because he was registered as an American citizen, he was called to the service. He was, I believe, 18 or 19 years old. So we met during that vacation. Then he got his draft papers. Before he was shipped to Vietnam, he wrote to me and said, I want to come visit you in Mexico, which he did. And after he visited me, he went off to Vietnam. During a year, he wrote every time he could. I had a bunch of letters, which I kept. And in these letters, he would include photographs or mementos that he would get on a mission. He would arrive into a village and there would be empty houses, and he would pick up these little mementos, which he sent to me. And I kept all that for all these years. A year later, I received a telegram from the American Embassy telling me he had been killed. He died the death of a hero. The Viet Cong had thrown a grenade in the midst of the group where he was with his fellow soldiers, and he threw himself over the grenade to save them. And I also received a letter from his mother telling me how much he loved me and how sad it was that what he wanted to do, which was to marry me after he returned, that would never happen. So with the grief of having lost, I wouldn't have called him my boyfriend, but a friend. I carried that all these years until 2 years ago. A friend of mine asked me about that box of letters that I've been keeping for ages. And he said, but that's a shame that you just have them in a box and nobody knows this story. Well, coincidentally, I had found out that there is in Chicago the Pritzker Military Library and Museum. So I copied all the letters, and then I took everything to the Pritzker Military Library. He was a wonderful young man, and really the story of a very young life that was cut super short. He had to grow up so quickly in the face of all the danger in Vietnam for a country that he really didn't know. And he certainly would not have gone into the army if he hadn't been compelled to.
That was Adriana Bonowitz of Libertyville, Illinois. She shared her experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
And now to Birdability Week that is underway. It's a celebration of birders with disabilities and other health concerns and an opportunity to share resources and ideas to help the birding community be accessible, be inclusive and welcoming. So what challenges do you face when trying to go to a state park? Are trails easily accessible or is it a challenge with your equipment? 800-642-1234. Monica Spaney is president of Accessibility Wisconsin. It's a nonprofit providing all-terrain wheelchairs for people exploring the outdoors. Monica, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you, Kate.
And we also have Caitlin Schwabeck, communication specialist with the Madison Audubon Society. Caitlin, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks so much, Kate. Great to be here.
Well, Caitlin, I'll start with you, but Monica, I also want to get your reflections on Birdability Week. And Caitlin, what does this event mean to you and this perspective?
Yeah, so many people think about birding as a really intense group of competitive people running around with binoculars. But that excludes so many folks who love birds but enjoy them in a multitude of other ways. We believe that anyone who enjoys birds can be a birder and should be welcomed into the community. And Birdability Week is a really great way for us to move towards that goal. Birdability, the organization, has, I got to give them a little nod just to start out. Their website is birdability.org. They have so many great resources and events happening all week long that I encourage folks to check out their site too.
Yeah, and Monica, what does this week mean to you?
Well, I think this week is significant in two ways. One, our relationship with the Madison Audubon Society helped promote field trips and an activity that includes everybody with a mobility challenge, whether it's a heart issue or a wheelchair user. So that in and of itself is wonderful. In addition, just being able to work with the Audubon Society on something tangible like this is wonderful. They were one of our first supporters when we wrote one of our first grants trying to get people outdoors to be birders. So this has been a long relationship, and Birdability has helped lots of individuals, friends and families, to get outdoors together.
Yeah, it sounds like a really great partnership with Audubon. And Monica, you work to break down barriers to mobility. What is it like now for Wisconsinites who have disabilities to get around in a state park, for instance, and go birding?
Well, just being in a natural setting is very difficult with people with mobility challenges. Because birds really don't necessarily land where there's flat surfaces. And so the advantage of being able to use these chairs, working with state, city, and municipal parks is wonderful because you get to see birds in their natural setting and other wildlife in their natural setting. And because the chairs tilt with you, and you're going walking speed, they're quiet. So this is why AAW, Accessibility Wisconsin, says being able to use this type of equipment allows outdoors access for all.
Yeah, give us a little bit more of a visual of these chairs, of this equipment and the wheels or how they get around on different types of pavement.
Well, what's wonderful is you guys have hiking boots. You put on special boots to go hiking. These are our hiking boots. So they have a special track that will help you go up over logs or through some water or over stones, and not gravel paths are not very easy for most people with mobility challenges. So you've got the tracks that go. But then the other advantage of this equipment is that it tilts with you. So if you're going up a hill, you can tilt it so you stay level. Hmm. And if you're going down a hill, you can tilt it so you stay level. You're not constantly out of balance. So that's another advantage of these hiking boots. The disadvantage of these hiking boots is they're very expensive, and most people have a hard time getting them to locations. So the Madison Autobahn, working with us, is showing people how if we can have these stationed at or hosted at state parks or nature centers, then we have an advantage that people don't actually have to tow them to get themselves out in nature. They can be there. So our relationship with Middleton Parks, where this BirdAbility event happened, we have an outdoor wheelchair actually hosted there so that you can go to our website, accessabilitywi.org, and see where these $20,000 plus pieces of hiking boots can be used for free with minimal deposits.
And really, meeting people where they're at. That's what I'm hearing, so that people can get access where they need it.
That is correct. They can get access where they need it, and then they can also transport the equipment to other locations. But our relationship with Middleton Parks, our relationship with, believe it or not, River Edge Nature Center in Ozaukee County and other counties help promote getting people outdoors. And Madison Autobahn has been a wonderful partner in starting that process and continuing it all the way up to field trips.
And Caitlin, you know, just a moment here on the birds. It's been quite warm this fall. What birds can we see in Wisconsin, and including perhaps some that haven't migrated yet?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kate. We are still seeing some late fall migrants making their way through, in addition to, you know, what I call the classics, which are like robins, cardinals, blue jays, and some of our other year-round birds. Right now, there's a good number of seasonal sparrows in the area. So we're starting to see more white-throated sparrows, white-crowned sparrows, dark-eyed juncos, to name a few. And soon we can expect that as it gets a bit colder, we'll begin to see some wintry finches and waterfowl. That's kind of one of the next big groups that starts to visit.
Yeah.
On Sunday at our outing with Accessibility Wisconsin, we saw tons of American goldfinches, a couple red-winged blackbirds hanging around, bald eagles, and there was a good-sized flock of just gorgeous sandhill cranes that sort of flew around and posed for us. So it was really a lovely outing on Sunday.
We have the Madison Audubon Society's Caitlin Schwabik and Monica Spaney here, who leads Accessibility Wisconsin. They're here on BirdAbility Week. Have you visited the new and completely accessible Eagle Tower in Peninsula State Park in Door County? What state park do you go to most that has the best accommodations? What do you love about birding and being in nature? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about BirdAbility Week, working to ensure the birding community and the outdoors are welcoming and inclusive, safe and accessible for everybody. Monica Spaney leads Accessibility Wisconsin, offering off-road wheelchairs through that grassroots nonprofit. And Caitlin Schwabik is with the Madison Audubon Society as a partner in this effort. They're with us for about nine more minutes. Monica, the Americans with Disabilities Act says that when a new park or recreation facility is built, it has to comply with accessible design standards. But for many parks built before these standards went into effect, it's basically left to local governments for compliance. What are you seeing out there as far as parks following outdated standards?
I feel that question is twofold. First of all, the American Disabilities Act is the minimum that needs to be done. People don't understand, for example, like a push button on a restroom is not a requirement. And so my thoughts are, even the new state parks, what can they do to really welcome everyone and make sure that everybody has in the independence to be able to enjoy the park just like anyone else. So that's part of it. And then for some state parks, I would actually like to talk about the Dane County Park.
Sure.
Dane County Parks has been working very hard to try to bring in accessible kayaks, work with us to host outdoor wheelchairs, and really look at accessible kayak launches. Accessible fishing from shore. And there are a lot of opportunities that they've researched to help people. And their planning is still continuing, but hopefully by 2022, some of that will come into play and we'll actually see some more accessibility in our parks in Dane County.
And Monica, what I'm also hearing is accessibility is not just confined to a trail that is accessible. There is so many details that go into making sure that a whole park or a recreational facility is open and able to welcome people. But the details really matter.
That is correct. And getting people's opinions and really trying to have a social network at a park, not leaving the youth home, the parent home, the grandparent home. That is so disheartening. And with the increase of access to the outdoors, you see you see depression decreasing, you see networking happening, and that's all very important to us as a society.
Caitlin, building that network in the birding community, what are you looking for in parks to improve accessibility?
Yeah, that's a great question. I, again, will mention Birdability because their website has so many of the options in great detail for how to make parks more accessible. But like we've been talking about, beyond the terrain and trails itself, you know, having accessible and unisex bathrooms, water fountains that are easy for people to use, accessible parking, benches and areas for people to rest along the trails, and having tactile and accessible signage are all also really important considerations. And another big thing that is valuable is when parks, trails, or sites clearly note those accessible features on their website so people know before they go. It really helps people feel welcome and safe when they arrive to kind of know what they're going to be encountering when they visit a site. Generally, I think all of us can do a better job learning what is helpful, inviting, and appropriate to say and do when it comes to making the birding community more accessible.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Caitlin Schwabick, who's communication specialist with the Madison Audubon Society. Monica Spaney is president of Accessibility Wisconsin as we explore Birdability Week with your insights as well. What state park do you go to? What recreation area has the best accommodations for people with disabilities? How has your family been able to go as a group to places and enjoy the outdoors? 800-642-1234. Caitlin, there's an event coming up Friday. The Madison Audubon Society is hosting Birding by Ear. It's a partnership with the Wisconsin Council of the Blind and Visually Impaired. Can you tell us about this event?
Yes, I definitely can. We work with the Wisconsin Council of the Blind and Visually Impaired to host a Birding by Ear course. We just hosted our fourth one this past spring, and we try and have regular meetups for those classes so that folks can get together to practice their birding by ear skills. So we're going to have one of those coming up on Friday. And if the Birding by Ear course sounds like it's interesting to anyone, I would definitely recommend keeping an eye out on our website for our course that will be coming next spring. Something that's really great about these courses and meetups is that it's really aimed at being inclusive and welcoming to everyone. Attendees include people with vision loss and other members of the community as well. So it's a really nice group that meshes together and gets to practice skills. And in addition to this, you know, we plan to continue building more partnerships and working together to offer even more experiences that will meet the diversity of birders and the birding community as a whole. So we're really excited about the possibilities moving ahead.
And I want to jump off the partnerships piece there, Monica, because as you talk about networking through the outdoors and networking with these organizations and these park facilities, what is the next step for accessibility to expand your offerings and to really take this to the next level?
Well, we work extremely hard to try to get at least one trailer and chair in every county, but what I feel our main message needs to be with networking is you can integrate your existing program and make it accessible by partnering with us. And that in and of itself opens up doors for the host or partnering organization to be able to then serve a more diverse population by integrating and not necessarily having to have the expense of the equipment, but working with us. So that's what our hope is.
How close are you to that goal? Is there a trailer and chair in every county?
We have 22 chairs as of this year, and we are right now serving 12 counties and are working on hitting our goal of 15, hopefully, by the end of the year, Kate. Oh,
that is awesome. Well, Caitlin, I just want to land quickly on a topic we talked about before, that this mysterious bird illness. And as you recall, there was all the talk about people taking down their bird feeders. Is there any update there?
Yeah, so we've added some updates to our website. As of right now, there has not been an instance of the illness found yet in Wisconsin. And as we move into fall and winter, people who want to put up bird feeders definitely can. We just recommend being, as usual, vigilant about keeping them clean and tidy.
Gotcha. Well, Monica and Caitlin, thank you for joining us.
Thanks again for having me. Great to be here.
Yeah. Thanks for having us. I appreciate it.
Yeah, Caitlin Schwabek, Communication Specialist with the Madison Audubon Society. Monica Spaney there, President of Accessibility Wisconsin. This is a nonprofit providing off-road wheelchairs to people with disabilities exploring the outdoors. Just ahead, we talk with Trapper Shep, a Milwaukee-based musician whose Americana style has resonated around the nation and the world. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.